It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, how big a problem are things like climate change, the federal budget deficit, race relations, and the economy? A new survey from UW-Madison asked Wisconsin residents about those and other issues. We'll find out what they had to say. First, we often hear elected officials and political analysts blame tribalism for stark division in the United States. The idea is we pick a side, a team, we dig in too far, and it becomes a case of us versus them. But our next guest says it doesn't have to be that way, and that our group identities can actually help us get along with others, even outside our own groups, if we do it right. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like the country's more divided than you've ever seen in your life? Why or why not? Do you think it comes from particular groups or the way we buy in, the way we pick sides, pick teams? What do you think can work to bridge those divisions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dominic Packer is a psychology professor at Lehigh University and co-author of the book, The Power of Us, Harnessing Our Shared Identities to Improve Performance, Increase Cooperation, and Promote Social Harmony. He wrote a piece for The Atlantic with his co-author called The Myth of Tribalism. Dominic, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me today.
Well, we sometimes hear this term tribalism thrown around a lot these days, I think, in American politics in particular. Can you offer us more of a definition of what people, of how people are using it?
Yeah, I think when people use the word tribalism, they're trying to reach for a sense of the toxicity of that group relations can turn into. And I think as we look out at our political landscape, there clearly are toxic relations both between groups, right? A lot of vitriolic language and dislike and unwillingness to compromise, and also some problematic dynamics even within groups, sort of intolerance of dissent and internal critique and people who might raise alternative ideas, especially if they're too much like the other side. And so when people use the word polarization, they're trying to capture that general sense that things have somehow gone off the rails. And although it's a good word to describe that, we don't think it's inevitable.
We'll get into that. I want to get to some of the basics of human group identity, though. It's a super natural thing for us to identify with a particular group of people or many different groups of people. Can you talk about that as a sort of fundamental bit of our humanity?
That's right. So we argue that human beings are fundamentally groupish, that if there's something built in and innate, it's not necessarily a tribal kind of instinct, and especially that sort of toxic group dynamic that I was talking about before. But certainly we have a strong propensity to identify with groups, so much so that you can put people in completely novel groups and they'll immediately feel some sort of allegiance to them. So there's these famous experiments from the 1970s that have informed a lot of the work that we do called the minimal group experiments, which essentially put people randomly into a group they've never heard of before, a team A or a team B, or we've often used the lions and the tigers. And as soon as you're part of that category, although you know nobody in that group, you're never going to interact with people in the group, it nevertheless starts to feel important to you. And when given the chance to, say, divide resources between your group and another group, people will tend to give more to their own team that, again, they'd never heard of even 5 minutes before. So there's certainly this readiness to identify with groups, and it comes on very quickly and strongly.
Well, I want to talk about a group you identify with, one you have with your co-author. You share a story in your book, one of you, a small town hockey playing kid, the other kind of a big city type, but skeptical of each other at first, brought together by a piece of cheese. Could you tell us a little bit about that story?
Right. So we met at graduate school at the University of Toronto and initially didn't get along that well, in part because my collaborator, Jay, moved from a small town in Alberta where he had lots of room into a tiny apartment in the middle of Toronto with no place to store his goalie equipment. So he decided to bring it into our shared office. And anyone who's played hockey or been around hockey players knows that that's smelly stuff. And it's a sub-basement office with no ventilation. So we weren't necessarily get us off on the right foot. But shortly thereafter, the department had an event, and afterwards there was a wine and cheese. And as we were in conversation with a group of people, Jay choked. This piece of cheese lodged in his throat and he couldn't breathe. And it took me a while to figure out what was going on. Initially, the bartender tried to give him the Heimlich and it actually dislodged. And then Jay grabbed me and dragged me to the bathroom opposite the reception room. And I figured out what was happening and I gave him the Heimlich, and eventually the cheese popped out and rolled across the floor. And I was horrified. I wanted to go home and collapse. And Jay thought it was hilarious and wanted to go and eat more cheese. But the stress of that moment sort of brought us together in a funny kind of way. And after that, we started talking to each other more and getting more interested in each other's ideas. And ultimately, we've now worked together for more than 15 years.
And I wanted to ask about that story, A, because there's cheese in it and we're in Wisconsin, but B, it's a very small scale example of a way that you were divided initially by a couple of your group identities. A unique shared experience brought you together. There could be lessons here, right?
Absolutely. So one of the things that can bring people together, in this case as a dyad, but in groups more generally, are adverse circumstances. We argue in our book that circumstances can often conspire to create a sense of solidarity. And sometimes these are good things that are happening, but sometimes they're bad things. In this particular example, right, choking on cheese is a pretty traumatic kind of event. But we see again and again, for example, during times of crisis, whether it's a natural disaster, some sort of terrorist attack, or even potentially a global pandemic, that in response to this common challenge, people can respond by recognizing they have common goals and that by working together, they can achieve those goals more effectively than they could on their own. And so it becomes a source of solidarity in moments of crisis.
Talking to psychology professor Dominic Packer, co-author of the book, The Power of Us. He co-wrote a piece for The Atlantic called The Myth of Tribalism, looking at our group identity, how it can divide us, but how it can bring us together, too. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Dominic, let's get into this tribalism idea now. What is it that determines if I'm in a group and I identify with it so strongly that it turns into a negative thing toward other people versus, I don't know, our shared values within that group that help us get along with people even outside that group?
That's right. So what we argue, and this is based on extensive research, both ours and other people's, is that when you identify with a group, that's almost like the fuel that drives your activity. It's propelling you to want to do things that you see as good for the group and pursue the group's goals. But what those activities are, what that behavior is very much determined by the norms of the group. And the norms set the direction. So it's like the identity is the fuel and the norms are the direction. And group norms can take all kinds of forms. They can certainly be toxic and insular and parochial and discriminatory. They can be anti-dissent. On the other hand, they can be open and warm and inclusive, both internally, seeking out criticism and enjoying and celebrating people who raise alternate ideas, but also even, you know, being helpful outside your group, and in some cases, in extreme cases, perhaps of charitable organizations, in some cases, doing more good outside the group than they would do internally. And so it's what the norms are that really shape people's behaviors. And for that reason, I think it's really important to get people thinking about group norms and not just the degree to which they identify.
Okay, so if I'm in a group, call it Team Republican or Team Democrat, say, and I feel like, yes, I believe in the principles that I share with this group, and I'm going to vote and I'm going to work for my team, but I'm worried that my team, my party, is getting too confrontational. It's not willing to follow the rules anymore. That worries me. That's betraying why I got into this. How can I start to try to change that or to bring back even that shared value?
I mean, that's the central question, or one of the central questions of the time we live in, I think. I mean, first of all, I think it's important to recognize what these dynamics are, which is one of the reasons we wrote this book, is helping people to see how powerful these group norms can be in shaping how we see the world and what we think is appropriate. And then to recognize that, well, maybe they're not necessarily always the best thing, and not necessarily in just an objective sense, but maybe they're not best thing for us, right? That for our group, this is having some negative consequences. And if you can get people to think about that, how is the way we're behaving counterproductive to our own long-term interests or to our sense of our own ethics or values, they can start to question those kinds of behaviors. So that's, I think, an important step, is to reflect on your own responses and behaviors and think how you might like to do things differently. And the other, I think, is to at least partially recognize the incentive structures, especially in online kind of social media environments, where people are being rewarded for incredibly divisive and incendiary kinds of rhetoric. And often it feels good when you see someone sort of hammering the other side and you see them insulting, and And so you give it a like or you give it a retweet. It's sort of like, yeah, let's go. What we would encourage people to do is take a step back from that. Again, if you don't like those norms, and a lot of people say they don't like how toxic it's become, then we need to stop rewarding it. Because the people who do this, the pundits and the politicians who engage in this sort of, overinflated inflammatory rhetoric, are responsive to incentives. They're doing it because it gets attention and because it gets rewarded by being spread widely.
We're talking with Lehigh University psychology professor Dominic Packer about social and political divisions, how to bridge them, and what he calls the myth of tribalism. He's co-author of the book, The Power of Us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a social group, a political group you feel like you identify with? Are there lots of them? And sometimes they might lead you in different directions. Do you think we have gotten too divided, especially politically, maybe socially in this country? What kind of things do you think would work to bridge those divides? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about tribalism with Dominic Packer. He co-wrote a new book called The Power of Us and a piece in The Atlantic on the myth of tribalism, looking at the ways that our group identities can bring us together instead of pulling us apart. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think we can or should become less divided as a society? Are you hopeful we could start to become a little more reunited? How would you like to see social groups held accountable when they engage in divisive behavior? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I don't really like the two-side narrative because, you know, there's 300 million people in the United States. People are different. We have, and then the other thing about that is that it's the divisive because it puts you into two sides, which I don't think it really should be. And then the internet allows people to say things that they would never say in person. So I think it's almost like anti-social media because people don't usually behave in the manner that they behave on the internet. And also, I remember the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, indivisible. And on our money, it says our motto, E Pluribus Unum. Out of many, one. And this is the idea that needs to be, you know, we're communities. We're not like sides. You know, we're not, I think that's just being used by politicians for power and influence.
Willem, thanks a lot for the call. Willem, Dominic gave us a lot to work with there. Where do you want to start?
I think Willem makes really great points. Sometimes the way political scientists talk about polarization is actually a useful way to think about it, I think. They describe polarized societies as societies where there's been a flattening of identity. You take a society where people have all sorts of different parts of themselves and they crisscross in ways that are not perfectly overlapping. So you have religious affiliations and there's where you live and there's your occupational identity and then there's your political beliefs. And they're all partially overlapping, but you're also part of different groups with different people who think differently from you. And that's a healthy way for society to be. It's also an exciting way to live. What happens with extreme polarization is all of that diversity of identity gets flattened into a single dimension so that everybody is essentially now being defined by where they fall on one spectrum from left to right. And it doesn't feel good and it's quite boring and it's certainly not healthy for societies. And so I think the point Lone's making is that a lot of people don't want that. They don't want to be flattened into that single sort of dimension. And we should be helping people recover aspects of themselves and bring other aspects of themselves to interactions with each other.
And it seems like you could do that, Dominic, on social media. But the opposite happens, as Willem points out. If you are in a political debate with someone online, it's really easy to collapse their identity and your own identity into that one dimension, that one side.
Absolutely. So we argue in our book that social media certainly didn't create polarization, but that it's acted as an accelerant. That if you introduce social media platforms into a society that's already struggling with this sort of issue, it tends to make things worse. And my collaborator, Jay at NYU, has done amazing work looking at the dynamics of interactions on social media platforms, and especially what sort of content in a tweet or a Facebook post tends to go viral. And what they find is that the content that's much more likely to be shared contains words that they describe as moral emotional, So they're not just moral words like good or bad. They're words like disgust or hate. There's these strong moralistic connotations and a ton of emotional content. And then if you pair that with a mention of the political outgroup, it's even more likely to go viral. And so this is the stuff that spreads online. And again, that incentivizes people who want to get attention, politicians and pundits in particular, to use that sort of language because it gets picked up and it gets shared in ways that have these pretty negative consequences overall.
Thanks for that call, Willem, at 800-642-1234. Mitch joins us next in Milwaukee. Mitch, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mitch?
I just wanted to bring up, I think that if we focused our education on teaching morals, ethics, and logic, we'd be much better off as a society than we are today.
And are you thinking, like, oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, Kantism specifically, like Kant. Moral philosophy.
Mitch, thanks for the call. Mitch thinks some early education in ethics and philosophy could help us out. What do you think, Dominic?
I think it couldn't hurt. One of the things we would argue in the book is that behavior is, because it's shaped by our identities, and we all have multiple identities, and they can come in and out of focus at different times, it's important to take that into account when we're thinking about ethics, because somebody who might live ethically and by a certain set of standards in much of their lives could still find themselves in a situation where they're part of a group with a very strong pattern of norms that would actually lead them away from that. And it's important to recognize that that can happen and to put it on pause and say, okay, I don't want to go down that road. I don't like these norms. I need to leave this group, or I need to try and change how this group is behaving.
Thanks for that call, Mitch, at 800-642-1234. Dominic, something that struck me in your book and that I've heard elsewhere sometimes is our perception of how divided we are. We hear from the most polarized people on social media and in the news sometimes, and looking at it through that lens, it might seem like everybody is at each other's throats. Everybody is leaping to one side or the other of the divide. But there's a lot of people out there who aren't so front and center. Do we need to focus more on them to get a better picture?
I think so. I think that a distorted picture, an over-exaggerated picture of polarization in some ways makes it worse. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's an important distinction between different kinds of polarization. One is called affective or emotional polarization. And I think there's little doubt that we are living through a peak of that kind of dynamic right now, that people feel a lot of negativity toward the other side. And in that sense, we are very polarized. But there's another kind of polarization, which is called issue or ideological polarization, which is much more about what do we actually think about real issues? Where do we stand on tax policy and how healthcare should work? Even something like gun control, which is very contested. And what you find in the American population is that when you actually drill down into real policy issues, there's way more agreement than people think there is. The left and the right actually tend to be pretty much aligned on a whole bunch of things where if only we could get past this emotional reaction, we could actually find some compromise. There's definitely room there to compromise. But if you don't see it, then you don't have those interactions. You don't have those conversations, and we don't actually move anything forward.
Talking to Dominic Packer, psychology professor, co-author of the book, The Power of Us, looking at a divided America, polarization, and how to overcome it. Let's go now to Jack in Viola. Jack, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. The issue I see, it's really nice to say, okay, let's all do us together. I mean, I really support that psychology. But when I've listened and seen a lot of things, it comes down to two principles. One is a zero-sum approach or strategy, and the other one is a win-win. And it seems this culture is really struck on that because, the win-win type of thing is the optimal strategy. The win-lose is a zero-sum strategy. And there are people who believe that, you know, their right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, you know, well, if it comes at your cost, it comes at your cost.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. Dominic, I know this is something that psychologists and political researchers think about a lot. What do you have to say to Jack?
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. I think if you see problems as inherently zero sum, we're competing over a resource, and if we win, you lose, and if you win, we lose, then it's very hard to reach compromise. And that if we can reframe problems to be one so that we have to find a solution where we all gain somehow, there's some greater collective benefit, then that is a path forward. And I'll give a plug just very quickly for somebody else's book called How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart by Jamal Green, there's a really interesting case to make about how the conception of rights as being zero sum, if I have a right, then you don't have a right, is part of the toxic dynamic in American politics, and that rethinking how we think about even something as fundamental as rights can help us reach that more win-win kind of approach.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute or so, Dominic, are you hopeful that we can get away from the us versus them, worst case, tribalized identities, and, I don't know, see each other as full people again?
Depends which day you ask me on. I think I'm hopeful that we can certainly do it, but I'm not always optimistic that we will do it quickly or that it'll be easy to do.
What's a step that you would recommend to somebody listening right now to, in their small way, help bridge that gap?
I would say when you're interacting with people online, offer some grace. You know, remember that people are multifaceted and that they probably have aspects of their identities that actually they share with you, even if it's not so visible. That's one thing. And the other is hold politicians and pundits to account. If they're using language you don't like, and many of us say we don't like this toxicity, then don't reward it. Whether it's the other side or your own side, just because it feels good to retweet something that's, you know, slamming the other side, don't retweet it if you don't like these dynamics.
Dominic, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Rob.
Dominic Packer is a psychology professor at Lehigh University, co-author of the book, The Power of Us, Harnessing Our Shared Identities to Improve Performance, Increase Cooperation, and Promote Social Harmony. He was with us today talking about social and political divisions and some of the ways we can help bridge them. Now, a new poll came out today showing us how Wisconsin residents feel about the biggest problems facing the state and the nation. And no surprise, Republicans and Democrats don't see eye to eye on many of those threats, but on others, there's some agreement. According to the La Follette policy poll from UW-Madison, 39% say climate change is the biggest issue confronting the U.S. That's the top problem facing Wisconsin as well, but only 27% said so. More Democrats than Republicans say they're worried about climate change, but when asked what should be done about it, the two sides are closer than you might think. The poll also got into how politically active people in Wisconsin are in terms of voting, giving money to candidates, working on campaigns, posting on social media, and other activities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the biggest problem facing the nation and why? How about here in the state? Do you want to see action on things like climate change? Do you feel a level of confidence in government? If so, which level of government? Call it at 800-642-1234. And are there any issues where you feel like you go against your political party or the one you agree with on most things? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan Webb-Yockey is director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs and a Collins Bascom Professor of Public Affairs and Political Science at UW-Madison. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of times, Susan, when people think of polls, they might think of those head-to-head matchups, say, in a political race. We're going to be seeing a lot of those this year. What were you setting out to find out in this survey?
Well, not that.
Right.
So you're right. There are a lot of political polls out there, and there should be. I mean, there's important information revealed in those polls. But the inaugural La Follette School policy poll really aims to do something very different. Our aim is to take the temperature on the state for our key public policy issues. We want to know what's on people's minds and what do they want to see addressed by our policymakers.
What was your biggest takeaway from the responses you got?
You know, it's a long survey, and it's an exciting survey in the sense that we are tapping ideas across the entire state. So here we have about 1,600 Wisconsinites who are willing to share their views on different public policy issues with us. That turns out to be about a 33% response rate, which is huge for survey research these days. We're really excited. And we have responses from 71 of the 72 counties in Wisconsin. So a great spread of Wisconsin attitudes. And one of the things that I was most interested in was really dissecting what are the top policy problems that Wisconsinites see today. That was the question that I was most excited about in answering the policy poll. But I'll say that there are a bunch of other questions on the poll representing some of the interests of other faculty members at the La Follette School, like on climate change, race relations, government regulation, and other matters.
Before we start to look at particular issues, one pretty consistent theme seems to be People are kind of worried about this issue, a lot of different issues as it affects Wisconsin. They're way more worried when you ask them about the national level. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting finding across the survey. And when I say across the survey, I mean across Republicans, independents, and Democrats. I mean across age brackets. I mean across genders. It is true that when we ask a bank of different policy topics to our respondents, and by a bank, I mean topics like climate change, education, healthcare, race relations, when we ask those topics to our citizens here in Wisconsin, we ask them at the national level and the state level, they're just much more concerned at the national level than they are at the state level.
Another thing that struck me, you know, Democrats way more worried, for example, than Republicans about climate change. Republicans were way more worried about the federal deficit, but it wasn't lockstep across the board. I think sometimes in politics, we think once you're on one side, you have this full menu of policy views. There's variation clearly among Republicans and among Democrats.
Absolutely. I mean, I found that really fascinating, too. I mean, it's no surprise that our poll reveals that Democrats in Wisconsin care more about climate change than Republicans. You know, if we found the opposite, we'd probably be scratching our heads, right? But what's really interesting here is the degree of separation. I mean, we have, in particular, I focused on the Democrats in the poll who were saying that climate change at the national level is an extremely big problem or quite a problem. So they're really focused on its degree of difficulty and for our country. And that grouping suggests about 87% of Democrats think that climate change is either quite a problem or an extremely big problem, while only 26% of Republicans think that. But what's interesting there is, hey, 26% right. of Republicans in Wisconsin think climate change is an extremely big problem or quite a problem. That's interesting in and of itself.
Talking to Susan Webb-Yaki, director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, talking about a new survey, first one out today, gauging Wisconsinites' opinions on a lot of different issues, what we see as some of the biggest problems facing the state and the country. And you could join in with your answer to that question at 800-642-1234. What do you see as the most urgent concern facing Wisconsin and the country as a whole? In an election year, a midterm election year, what do you want your candidates talking about? What answers do you need before you go and vote for someone? And how politically active are you? Have you worked for a candidate? Are you planning to do that this year? Do you post about politics online? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Susan, you asked people about their level of political participation. What kind of things did you find out?
We found that people are in Wisconsin participate a lot in government. They participate a lot by sharing their voice. And I should note that anybody that's interested in these results, take a look at them for yourselves. If you Google the La Follette School and policy poll, you're going to come up with this fabulous interactive website where you can break down all of the results in the survey in pretty much any way you want to, by race, by gender, by age, by political identification, and by question bank. So you've just asked about participation and how we participate in kind of the public square, if you will. One of the results that really surprised me from the La Follette School policy poll was the number of people that are using social media to participate in the public square. So 32% of the respondents said they posted about a political issue that matters to them within the last year. So 32% of folks are using social media to get active in politics and policymaking here in Wisconsin, according to our survey.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Oh, not quite right there. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. You know, I've contacted my congressman, the one current and the previous one, as well as...
Are you still there, Jeff?
Okay. Northern Wisconsin, we need to grow small business, and we need cell phone service up here. I know I work for a small business. We oftentimes cannot contact our customers, and we need broadband internet access through the state. We got to look forward, not backwards, in terms of serving everyone, in my opinion.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Your phone cut out a little, but I think we got the gist, illustrating your point, in fact. Susan, I don't know if your respondents weighed those particular issues, but you asked about attitudes toward the economy and other economic issues, Jeff giving one key example there.
Absolutely. And I do think it's funny that Jeff cut out when he was asking for more cell phone service. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, you know, that is something that we're seeing both our legislators and our governor talk a lot about this year's broadband coverage and cell phone service coverage across Wisconsin. That didn't come out in our poll. That's because we just didn't ask about it. Maybe that'll be for our next La Follette School policy poll. But we did ask about some related questions. So, for instance, we asked about the federal budget deficit, and we asked about the economy and taxes. But all of those issues polled really strongly, especially with Republicans. And one of the things I want to mention, when I was taking a look at these results, I was really interested in what our independents think about major issues facing our nation and our state. And in particular, independents in the survey, which were about 15 or 16% of our survey respondents, and it's about 15 or 16% of Wisconsinites too, they're mentioning that the federal budget deficit and healthcare are some of the top issues for them.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. We're taking a look at a new survey on what Wisconsinites think about various problems facing the state and the nation. Susan Webb-Yockey is with us, director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs, professor of public affairs and political science at UW-Madison. We've got a link to the results of the survey. You can find them at WPR.org/Central Time. And you can join in right now at 800-642-1234 with your own answers to the polling questions. What do you think is the biggest threat, the biggest problem for Wisconsin, for the country as a whole? What is the most urgent for you? Is it climate change, your personal finances, government regulation, racial equity, something else? What are you worried about as we head into a midterm election? And what do you want to hear candidates talking about? What do you want to hear the media asking candidates about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about the new La Follette policy poll from UW-Madison. It came out this morning. It shows what Wisconsin residents think are the biggest problems facing the state and the nation. For the state, the top three keeping people up at night are climate change, healthcare, and race relations. For national problems, it's, again, climate change, then the federal budget deficit, and the distribution of income and wealth. Susan Webb-Yockey is with us, director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs and professor of public affairs and political science at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you see as a top threat, a top problem facing Wisconsin, facing the U.S. as a whole. Also, let us know, how politically active are you? Do you vote? Do you contact public officials, go to public meetings, sign petitions, share political thoughts on social media? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Aiden is with us in Waterford. Aiden, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to talk about an issue that's been kind of pressing on me, and it's the how desensitized we've become to tragedy, especially in the past couple years, when we see these big numbers for COVID deaths and all of these riots and things happening in our country. We don't really view them the same way that I feel we used to. And I think that's an issue that we really need to actually address. I believe that losing an individual life is just as high a toll, and we should view it as such. And I don't think we do nowadays.
Aiden, thanks for sharing what you see as a big problem here. It's a subtle point to pull on, Susan, but interesting.
Yeah, it is an interesting point. And Aiden, you're not alone in feeling that way. I suggest a book to you by Deborah Stone. It's a book that captures, it's called The Policy Paradox. And I oftentimes will teach it in some of my policymaking classes at UW-Madison. And it's exactly on this point. It's thinking about how do we think about data and these big numbers, but really also understand the individual story. And that's a really important discrepancy, especially for policymakers. Policymakers are drawn to their constituents' individual stories. not big numbers. And sometimes they don't even really understand kind of big numbers and how to use them appropriately. Deborah Stone's book is a wonderful example of how to place those two topics in contrast with each other and try to understand the policymaking process better as a result.
Aidan, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Jeremy joins us now in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think the biggest issue that we face here in Wisconsin and throughout the country is an institutional crisis going on in our governing body, as a whole. It is incredibly difficult and heart-wrenching to watch these politicians politicize something as simple as building new roads or putting a bridge up or doing any type of infrastructural thing. It has been nothing but a gridlock for the past going on almost 20 years now, and the American people are getting really fed up with the Congress's inability to get the simplest things done. It's scholars are considering it an institutional crisis, and I believe that's exactly what it's going on. There is no consensus with anything anymore.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for the call. And Susan, in addition to asking people about the biggest problems, you asked about things like confidence in our government. Did a lot of people feel like Jeremy did?
A lot of people feel like Jeremy does, absolutely. And we found in the LaSalle School Policy Poll that the lowest levels of confidence in government are at the federal level, so are at the level of our national government. They're slightly higher for state government, and they're highest for local government here in Wisconsin.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jeremy, at 800-642-1234. Dan joins us next in Stevens Point. Dan, hi.
Hi there. I wanted to tell you, I've been contacting I've contacted President Biden, I've contacted my two senators, I've contacted my representative, I've contacted my mayor, and I've contacted my county executive all about climate change and the climate crisis that's ongoing and has been ongoing. I've been working on this for 10 years, and I'm not alone. There are thousands of us here in Wisconsin who are contacting our members of Congress, trying to get Congress to pass something that would put a price on carbon, which is, according to the economists nationwide and climate scientists worldwide, the strongest thing we can do to reduce the worst impacts of climate change. I have seen three derechos here in Portage County, where I live, in the past few years. Three derechos have come through. Before that, I had never even heard the word derecho. We've had floods. We've had 400 or 500-year floods here in Wisconsin in the past, 8 years or so. We've had terrible storms, and they're only going to continue, and they're only going to get worse unless we take the action that needs to happen.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, a lot of people in the survey share that worry with Dan. It's one of the top issues, the top worries people have, but it's also one of the biggest partisan divides among issues people take seriously, right?
It absolutely is. Yeah. So it is, for Democrats, one of the top issues that we polled on. It is just off the charts, considered to be an extremely big or quite a big problem by Democrats. It also is a pretty large problem for Wisconsin independents. And so this is an area that has changed across time. The LaFalle School Policy Poll not only identified climate change as an important problem for a certain sector of Wisconsinites, it also asked a separate question, actually a series of questions on what we should do about climate change. So I'll preview one set of questions with you right now. So for instance, we asked our respondents, again, about 1,600 Wisconsinites spread all across our state. So we asked, should our state government, in your opinion, do more or less than it currently is to address climate change? Only about 9.6, so about 10%, said that they should be doing less than they're doing now. So our state government should be doing less on climate change. But a whopping 62% of respondents said that our state should be doing somewhat more or a lot more than it's doing right now to address climate change here in Wisconsin.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. We're looking at the new La Follette Policy Poll from UW-Madison. Susan Webb-Yaki is with us, sharing some of the results. You can find a link to the whole shebang at WPR.org/Central Time. Susan, you mentioned earlier you could break down results by different groups, so we've kind of focused on Democrats and Republicans. There were some interesting things in a couple other ways of looking at it, including youth and age. What kind of differences did you see there among age groups?
Yeah, our younger respondents, you know, I'm a college professor. I work with young students all the time. And so I'm really interested in thinking about how our younger cohort of respondents is thinking about policy problems here in Wisconsin. And we're seeing some really interesting results. Climate change, again, that's a theme that's been coming up a lot today. But let me bring up another, and that's healthcare. Healthcare is a really interesting topic in our survey. It actually is one of the top topics for all age groups, our youngest respondents and our oldest respondents in the survey. It also, interestingly, is perceived to be a major problem by Republicans, independents, and Democrats. So here's one of these consensus issues. So, you know, if you're a policymaker out there, you're wondering, where are the consensus topics for my constituencies? Here's one in Wisconsin, that's healthcare. And it's ranked very highly by young people as well.
What are you hoping people do with the survey results, whether it's policymakers or citizens around the state?
It's our hope to use the survey in a couple different ways. One, we're going to use it in the classroom. We're an evidence-based institution. We want to lead with how people think, feel, and experience government. And so we're going to use it in our classes. Our faculty at the La Follette School will also use it in their research, but we want to use it in our outreach as well. So to, you know, share on programs like this with other citizens in Wisconsin, what do they most care about and how might they get active and engaged in trying to address those issues as well?
In a conversation we had earlier today, we talked about our divides, our partisan divides in the country. You just mentioned healthcare as a common ground. Do you hope that this survey can be part of informing us about ways that maybe we're not always so divided?
Absolutely. I do. You know, and interestingly, there's a, you know, big question bank on water policy in the survey, right? And one of the things, the takeaway messages from the respondents, so our fellow Wisconsinites, what do they really feel about water policy in Wisconsin? And one of the messages we're seeing across those questions is that they really feel like the polluters, people that are polluting, ought to pay. Sort of a polluter should pay message. It's coming out of the results. We wouldn't have known that before the La Follette School policy poll. So this inaugural policy poll is already shedding light on important topics here in Wisconsin, like water policy.
I know one big goal for surveys that go on over time is to not just get snapshots in time, but see how things change, how attitudes change on issues. Are you hoping to do a series of surveys? If so, how often?
That's a great question. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that we're an evidence-based institution. We are. And so we're going to look at the evidence. So, you know, if this survey gets used, and if this survey is appreciated by Wisconsinites, by our students, by our faculty, by our broader public, then we're going to do it again. And if it's not, then we'll move on to something else that's important for our state.
As we wrap up, what are you watching for next as you watch for ways to understand what we in Wisconsin think about the big issues?
Well, I think we are in the middle of an ongoing crisis in healthcare. Right now, it's COVID, and our hospitals in Wisconsin are certainly being dramatically impacted by it. I'm watching that issue very closely across this next election. We move into these statewide gubernatorial and U.S. Senate elections. I demand that our policymakers address important issues.
Susan, thanks for joining us. That's Susan Webb-Yockey, director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs. We talked to her about the new La Follette policy poll showing Wisconsin residents split along party lines on some issues, some room for agreement as well.